Item 14, a Pinniped briefing. Briefing on public input, possible commission guidance. Nate Pamplin. You want to come up too, Penny, in case we have questions for you?
I would gladly sit in the front in case you have any questions.
Very good. She doesn't want to come up.
Vice Chair, Commissioners, Director. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the Policy Director with the Department. This issue is on pinniped management has come up in a variety of forums here over the past year. Certainly a big topic within the Governor's Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force as a contributing factor to the competition of prey with killer whales. There was also a workshop, work session with the Senate Natural Resources Committee in about February, where myself and a couple other scientists, or two scientists, one from a fish program, one from our wildlife program, gave a briefing to the Senate about Marine Mammal Protection Act and just pinniped life history and an update on the Columbia River management activities. And then finally, in January, when NIMS determined that the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan was deemed insufficient, the Commission had a conference call and directed the Department, as we rework that plan, along with co-managers, to look into a few other items. And one of those was the effects of pinniped management. So that's triggered some additional analyses that we were going to bring forward to you in September, but I was going to introduce that towards the tail end of the talk today. And then I visited with a number of you about the Marine Mammal Protection Act and gone through some of the requirements to be able to conduct lethal take and management. And just thought it would be good to bring this forward to the full commission. It's a topic in the news right now. It's real easy to have a lot of misinformation out there. And so just wanted to try to get everybody on the same playing field associated with the law and what's going on here. So today I'll touch on life history and abundance of pinniped species in Washington. I'll present a short overview of two research papers that actually three research papers that have come out here in the past year or so. Then I'll dive into an overview of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and we'll focus on the Columbia River as a case study of how the MMPA is implemented under Section 120. I'll then review some recent legislation that's going through Congress right now, and then again touch on some of the bioenergetics modeling that staff are working on. There are five pinniped species in Washington. The northern elephant seal and the northern fur seal are primarily pelagic species, and so we'll not be discussing them further for the rest of the presentations. So when I'm talking about pinnipeds for the rest of the talk, I'm really referring to harbor seals, California sea lions, and stellar sea lions.
What's pelagic?
Offshore. They tend to spend a majority of their time out on the ocean. They'll come ashore to haul out and rest and for breeding. So shifting to harbor seals, this is the most common pinniped species in Washington. Males and females generally are similar size, up to about 250 pounds. They're a resident species. They tend to have pretty high site fidelity to haul out sites. And harbor seals in Washington tend to pup on different seasons, depending on where you are in the state. On the outer coast, they'll pup in June, July, but coming into Puget Sound, they'll pup a little bit later in the summer, in the July through September period. Harbor seals and California sea lions and stellar sea lions all just have one pup a year. Harbor seals tend to have a pup every year, and females can have pups as early as like 4 years old. In terms of their diet, harbor seals are considered generalist. Looking at some data from South Sound here, the diet consists of more than 50 fish species. It's dominated by hake, a variety of other forage fish, and octopus and squid are common. About only 4% of the scats had remains of salmonids, and both adult and juvenile salmon were present. Just showing some other diet studies from around the Sound, where in the Strait of Georgia, salmon made up to 9% of the diet. In the 90s, another study showed that juvenile Chinook in the Strait of Georgia was about 3% of the diet, with adult Chinook constituting about 7%. And then a study more recently in the San Juan Island showed that Chinook comprised about 2% of the harbor seal diet. I should mention, too, that a lot of times on diet data...
Mr. Baker?
Thanks. Nate, the question about the predominance of different kinds of fish in the diet, how connected is that to whether the fish are here or not? I mean, there's salmon aren't down here in the South Sound all the time, and so is there a connection with there?
Right, and that's absolutely there is, and so all of this is dependent on when the scats are collected. So it's these studies. You can make a lot of assumptions when you go through bioenergetics modeling, and take for instance one forage study and apply it to year round, or if you applied it to a broader geographic area. Certainly, those you're making a lot of assumptions in doing so. And so that's why we're doing some additional analyses using more localized data that I'll explain a little bit later.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. And let me start by saying thanks for the presentation. I know you have been busy on a variety of things for preparing for this commission meeting. As we saw yesterday, this presentation wasn't up until just before the meeting. So it's been difficult to do the advanced preparation that maybe I would have liked to have done. On the percentage of the scats for harbor seals that have salmon remains in them, and then some of these numbers that seem relatively low, I wonder, and when you put this in the context of some of the science that I think you're going to get into later, where it shows that the consumption of salmonids by sea lions has increased by some of the science 10 or 20 times over the course of 1970 to the current. It would lead one to think, well, it's just a small percentage here. Perhaps that's not that big of a problem. So is there a difference between what's shown in the scats and what the total consumption is? Maybe you'll get to that later. My direct question on this one was about when the scats are collected. So, you know, we've got some of this business reporting that the harbor seals in particular are focusing on juvenile salmon right at the time of out-migration. There's even these reports of sea lions being present at the outfall of hatcheries on the Columbia River when they're being released right there. So are these scats taken during that time frame, or are they taken throughout the year? Is this an average over the course of the year? Does this information get specific enough and be taken in those kind of locations to see different percentages than these very low numbers?
Mr. Vice Chair, Commissioner McIsaac, great question, and that's really kind of ties off of Commissioner Baker's question. So a lot of these studies, the scat samples, I believe are collected during the summer. I think some of them are in the spring and in the fall, and I just don't remember the details of each study. I believe this top study here from the 1990s of Strait of Georgia was some of the data that was used in the Chasco paper. So, for instance, some of those scats, you know, are collected kind of near from harbor seals near the mouth of the Fraser River. And so it has certainly a higher percentage of their diet is smolts, but you can still see it's a pretty low percentage even in that context. In terms of the numbers that you see, it really has to do with, while it's a low percentage of the diet, there's a lot of harbor seals. And so that's where you see the amount of impact that's shown in some of the Chasco papers.
Nate, I have a question, and maybe you're going to get to it, but the population increase over the last 25 years, 30 years, has been very, very significant on harbor seals. Maybe you do you have that data, or can you get it? That's the first part of the question. The other part of the question that I have is there's an anticipated push for increased Chinook production for a variety of reasons. I don't need to go into that. So you guys are the scientists, not me, but I've been around Mother Nature for quite a while. So if you increase the production of Chinook, first smolts and then adults returning, Mother Nature will react and there will be a significant increase again in pinnipeds. So what do we anticipate there? Well, don't shake your head at me, Penny. I'm sorry, I've seen it, and I think you might have seen it too. So,
right. So I'll present some information about population status of each of the three species here in just a few slides. As far as how predators will respond to the increasing of production of smolts, don't know. I mean, there's a variety of factors here. I'm going to explain some of those a little bit further on, but it's an incredibly complicated system, and we're just taking a narrow slice into one prey item and one predator. And we know there are hundreds of prey items, and we know there are dozens of predators. And so it's pretty easy to do the back-of-the-envelope calculation.
Any other questions before Nate continues? Okay, thank you, Nate.
Thanks. Maybe I'll just, as we're talking about diet information and the bioenergetics modeling, before I go through the other species, maybe it's just worth just a quick example. Let's just shift to a system that perhaps folks around the panel are more familiar with. Let's just think about black bears eating elk. So, on average, how many elk do you think a black bear eats in a year? Is it two? Is it five? I see a two.
Five.
Well, there's 25,000 black bears in the state, and there's 60,000 elk. So if a black bear ate two elk a year, we would essentially be out of elk. So we know it's more complicated than that. We know that black bears hibernate for several months of the year. We know that black bears are in areas of the state where there aren't elk. We know that black bears might scavenge elk. So some of the diet data that you might see is actually that something else killed that elk and black bear fed on it. So there's a lot of the factors that go into understanding some of these ecosystem dynamics. The couple papers that I'm going to present, I thought did a really good job teasing out the data that we have available. And there's some pretty eyebrow-raising results that I think are validating what folks are seeing out in the field. And so we'll go into that in a little more detail. Another aspect I should mention about diet studies is there's the percent of diet and then the frequency of occurrence. And the frequency of occurrence is also presented as a percent. So a percent of diet is basically if we just looked at all the food items that I ate yesterday and it summed to one, that would be 100%. A frequency of occurrence might be, I ask everybody here, have you eaten fast food over this calendar year? And perhaps everybody's hand goes up, and then it would say, well, the frequency of occurrence is that it's 100%. And then I asked if everybody's eaten an apple over the past year, the frequency of occurrence would be 100%. So frequency of occurrence information needs to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt. It's just the number of times a species has shown up in the diet across a variety of scats collected. So, and there's ways that folks translate the frequency of occurrence information into percent diet. And so some of the studies I'm going to show you is frequency of occurrence. Back to harbor seals, there are four stocks that NIMS has to use as management units within Washington. Previously, there was just was managed as two, the Oregon and Washington outer coastal stock, and then the inland Washington waters. The inland Washington water stock has now been divided up into three stocks. That'll be important later on when we talk about potential management options. So just want to have you keep that in mind. This slide just shows the distribution of harbor seals on different haul-out sites across the state. Again, it's most common pinniped in our waters. This is starting to touch into Commissioner Carpenter's observation about harbor seal recovery. This was a study done by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in Canada where they reconstructed the historical harbor seal abundance and essentially back to pre-contact levels. They were able to look at, I think, some of the seal data that was collected during some of the bounty times, pre-60s, pre-40s. Within Washington State, the population has increased to about 30,000 animals in the state and has leveled off, so we're probably at the carrying capacity. Just some more recent data that our staff have pulled together as part of the analyses that we've been working on, where we had a series of more frequent surveys almost annually up through 2000, and then we had to stop the frequency of surveys due to funding, and we had some Navy contracts more recently and did some surveys in 2014-15 timeframe, and we're still at probably at that plateau of at carrying capacity or perhaps even slightly declining.
Commissioner McKaysey.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. A couple of slides earlier, let's see, slide number 9. You show the historical reconstruction back through time, all the way back to not quite when Henry Clay was actually serving in the Senate, but 1880, and I know it's difficult to get those back. But in general, it shows that now the population might be as high as it was back in some pretty pristine time. So when you look at these, this is for abundance in British Columbia. When you go to slide 11 and you look at just the recent data now for Puget Sound, Strait of Juan de Fuca, San Juan Islands, you see a similar kind of burst of abundance going on from the 1970s to now. Is there a feeling that the abundance now is up? You mentioned carrying capacity is up to what the abundance was back in some pretty pristine time frames here as well as in British Columbia?
I think that's a reasonable thing to conclude. I think the DFO study is for British Columbia. We haven't done the hindcast here in Puget Sound, but just looking at the population behavior here where it's leveling off at carrying capacity, whether it's the carrying capacity today is the equivalent to the carrying capacity of 1880, don't have any idea, but that's the way the population is behaving now.
This might be, well, why don't you explain? Explain carrying capacity. I mean, I think I know what it is, but I'd like to hear what the factors are that affects change on that.
Sure. Okay. There was a nice slide yesterday in the Wolf Overview by Scott McCorkadale that had a kind of a quick primer on population dynamics. Carrying capacity is essentially the level at which the populations are at their highest level in concert with the available resources. So sometimes it might be a space limitation or it might be a resource, other type of food limitation. Oftentimes when you don't have other harvest removals, and in this case where Marine Mammal Protection Act came into effect in 1972 and human-caused mortality essentially stopped other than some bycatch and fisheries, populations are able to grow at essentially their maximum net productivity level. And you'll see that continue until they start becoming resource limited. Sometimes populations will overshoot and then correct back down, and then they'll finally try to hit some sort of equilibrium, and that's assuming the ecosystem's static, which we know that's not accurate either, so or doesn't play out that way. So I'll have a slide here coming up that just shows graphically a couple terms in the Marine Mammal Protection Act that are also helpful.
Commissioner Holzmiller, and then Commissioner Thorburn, please.
Watched a really cool show on the Discovery Channel the other night about this, the killer whales eating, but now are the killer whales around here don't, I guess to the point, what is there any predator animals on these harbor seals?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Vice Chair, Commissioner Holzmiller. There are three ecotypes of killer whales. There's the resident type that tend to focus on salmon, in particular Chinook. There's the transient killer whale that are marine mammal eaters, and they'll certainly eat harbor seals and Stellar sea lions, California sea lions. And then there's the offshore type that we think focus more on tuna and sharks and other species.
But that being said, are there many predators on these harbor seals?
There's probably sharks and killer whales.
Yeah, so basically not much.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Harbor seals and then the two sea lions hunted, because you mentioned bounties is accounting for that drop. Bounty hunting is accounting for that drop in the British Columbia population. Were any of these species hunted for hides or in the past?
Commissioner Thorburn, in between 1940 and 1960, within Puget Sound, about 17,000 harbor seals were removed from a state bounty program.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll jump to California sea lions now. California sea lions, the males weigh between 200 and 1,000 pounds, and it's really males that you see in Washington waters. They leave the breeding grounds in California in the fall. They'll come up here to feed over winter, and then about by early May, mid-May, they're heading south back down to California to the breeding grounds. Looking at their diet, again, similar to harbor seals, it's dominated by hake, followed by dogfish, salmon, and other forage fish. Using the frequency of occurrence statistic here, salmon are found within about 5 to 25% of the scats collected, and there's a variety of studies there that are cited with different areas around Puget Sound. This map just shows the distribution of California sea lions in Washington waters and reflects this graphic just shows the seasonal distribution. Again, during the summer, they're down south. They pick up in the fall and then leave later in the spring. Across this stock, there are up to about 275,000 to 280,000 animals. The representation of the letter K represents carrying capacity here, and the MNPL represents the level of maximum net productivity level. That's where probably the population, it's the inflection point on the growth curve. It's the greatest rate of population increase when you look at a population modeled over time. Another thing to point out is in the Marine Mammal Protection Act, there's a term I'll discuss later called Optimum Sustainable Population Size, OSP. And OSP is considered that range between MNPL and K. So that upper half of the population is considered where a population is going to be stable. It's above that maximum net productivity level, and it's within its ecological function. I'm your policy director, and I'm sharing a lot of science here, so we're going to keep moving through. Stellar sea lion diet, or stellar sea lions, excuse me. Males will weigh up to about a ton. Females are around 700 pounds. We have both sexes here in Washington. They're not migratory per se, but they do make large seasonal movements following prey around. They were federally, the eastern stock of stellar sea lions were federally delisted in 2013, and the commission state delisted stellar sea lions in 2015. They also, their diet's dominated by hake. Salmon comprises about 10% of their overall diet. And then of the salmon species that are identified in their scats, that Chinook comprise almost 20%.
Commissioner Thorburn?
I have a reproductive question about sea lions, particularly in reference to the California sea lion. Do they pair, or is there a dominant male that breeds? What's known about that? And I guess the reason for my question is that it could make a difference in terms of lethal take of sea lions, California sea lions in particular, in Washington State, it seems like, on a population impact.
They tend to I believe they'll hold territory, and so they'll breed with multiple females on the breeding ground. So the bigger bulls try to get back and kind of hold a prime spot. Stellar sea lions do have a lower productivity rate than California sea lions. They tend to pup, the females tend to pup every other year. So you'll see a slightly lower growth rate there. But their population has increased 2 to 3%, 4% per year since the Marine Mammal Protection Act went into effect. So just to summarize the status of populations, pinniped populations within Washington, this slide shows the four different stocks of harbor seals and their population level. So this is the center column here shows the stock population estimate, and then the column to the right just shows the proportion that's in Washington. I would call out, I got some more recent data as after I submitted this for posting online for California sea lions. I just had the data for inland waters, and that only represented population on Navy facilities based on the contract. So there's about 1,000 California sea lions in Puget Sound, about 9,000 on the outer coast, and 3,000 or so along the towards the mouth of the Columbia River. So about 13,000 California sea lions will be seasonally in Washington.
Mr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Seasonally in Washington, I guess, gets to my question. And 3,000 in the Columbia River area. So the last picture on your fact sheet slide shows some sea lions down on the docks in where Commissioner Graybill's headed here tomorrow. I don't know if you can count 3,000 on that one dock, but I know that there's other pictures of the Desdemona Sands down there where the number is quite high. So seasonally, 3,000. And then you've got that that graph earlier that shows 300,000 coast-wide. So in the summer right now, if that picture was taken in the summer, and they're supposed to mostly be down in California, with 3,000 must be at the seasonal low point. So when you say 3,000 for the Columbia River, what season are you speaking of?
Referring to the winter and spring.
Okay. Yeah. Seems kind of low.
Just sharing information from our marine mammal scientist who's worked with us for almost 40 years. So there's three papers that I'd like to touch on. Two were by Chasko et al. That came out in 2017. They refer to they describe the spatiotemporal bioenergetics model for across the coast. One of their publications looks at pinniped population effects on salmon across the eastern North Pacific, and another looks at it just within Washington waters. They estimated the consumption of Chinook salmon from 1970 to 2015. And they're modeled the energetic costs and demands for both killer whales, California sea lions, stellar sea lions, and harbor seals. And they compared those energetic needs with Chinook abundance. The authors found that Chinook consumed by killer whales and pinnipeds has increased from 6,000 to 15,000 metric tons. That killer whales consume the largest biomass of Chinook, but harbor seals consume the most individuals, and in particular here by feeding on juvenile smolts. That they showed that commercial and recreational fishing had declined from 16 to 10 metric tons, and that they suggested that predation could essentially be masking the benefits of recovery, as increases from recovery could be offset by predation. Essentially, they showed that pinnipeds are consuming twice as many salmon as killer whales, and six times the amount of catch of combined for commercial and recreational fisheries. Another publication is by Nelson and co-authors, where they assess the potential impacts of harbor seal predation and hatchery releases on 20 wild Chinook stocks in British Columbia and Washington. They found that the density of harbor seals in this area was negatively associated with Chinook productivity. That is, as seal density went up, the stock MSYs went down. And they also showed that their analysis did not support that hatchery smolt abundance was negatively impacted by the marine survival of wild Chinook. So essentially, there's a lot of folks have hypothesized that with the increased release of hatchery fish, that are competing with wild fish. And they found that the probably the better explanation of the decline of salmon was not because of the increased hatchery releases. It had to do with the increase of seal density. The authors did acknowledge that there's likely a composite of factors that make juvenile salmon vulnerable to opportunistic predators like seals. So any questions on any of the bioenergetic stuff? Then I'll shift to the MMPA.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. There's another Chasko et al. Paper that came out in the NRC Research Press that talks about pinniped consuming double that of killer whales and six times greater than the combined commercial and recreational catches when you convert the juvenile Chinook salmon to adult equivalents. And this was by 2015. Is that consistent with what your prior slides were saying on bioenergetics and relativity to killer whales and
yes,
that?
Yes, and yes, Commissioner McIsaac, I just shared that fact as well. Yes, that's correct.
Commissioner Baker.
So my question is the reason for this briefing is it's important for us to know this. But is what we're leading up to whether we give the agency some guidance on whether we support, oppose, or are neutral to the bills that are going through Congress or not? Or is there another reason? And the reason I ask the question is we have very, very influential members of our legislature who want us to go much further. And you know this. They want us to use a piece of the Marine Mammal Protection Act that would allow us to manage these populations. They are not satisfied yet with our, maybe it's not a good idea, and I assume there might be legislation on that coming up. So what I'm trying to do is put this into perspective. Why are we doing this?
Mr. Vice Chairman?
Mr. McIsaac.
Not to shortstop this answer here, but when this agenda item was originally set up was in April, and that was when at the front table here we talked about whether or not there ought to be a position or whether or not any of us could have a position on the questions that were going forward for legislation matters. So it was a very general question, a very generic, it's the description of the first, as you mentioned there. A higher level policy decision of whether the commission would endorse any changes in federal legislation or state legislation relative to the management of pinnipeds. And so I never, in April, I think Commissioner Kehoe said, well, I think we ought to have public testimony before we decide. And I think there were some other folks at the front table that said, yeah, let's take our time and think a little bit about that. But I don't believe it was ever to get real specific about numbers of take or any of that kind of thing. Since then, I have found out the staff has been doing a lot of work and preparing a lot of things on bioenergetics, salmon recovery modeling, lots of technical information that could get to real specific questions. But in April, when this was placed on this agenda item in August, the purpose was just very general. All this is informative, but Mr. Pamplin talks about another presentation to get really into the details, and so I'm coming from this from a perspective of just the higher level general intent that was expressed back in April.
Okay.
Mr. Baker, do you have a follow-up on that?
If there is a suggested guidance prepared on this, I might have missed it. And so I'm just trying to put the presentation in a context that what we're going to be asked to decide at the end of the presentation, I think it would be much bigger news if we chose not to support the three governors that have written the letter to Congress. I assume they all have scientists who are giving them similar briefings. And so I think also that this is a to be continued question. And so that for that reason, this is a good briefing, and it's very interesting to know these facts and figures. But I'd be interested in also in what kind of guidance we are going to be asked to provide. Thank you.
And thanks, Commissioner Baker. I'm just hoping some of this foundational information, in particular as I go through the MMPA and some of the case studies on the Columbia River, and then to start thinking about, I think it's really easy for folks to jump to, well, you know, you look at the harbor seal population growth and you look at the bioenergetics modeling and it goes to, okay, let's do removals. Let's think about removals in the context of whether or not it would have an impact. Let's think about it in terms of what options we have under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Let's think about the logistics. Let's think about the socio-political side. So I think there's, as you've indicated, to be continued. I think that's very accurate. There's still a lot of just some groundwork that I think needs to be established before going forward. Having said that, we do have some legislation going on in the Columbia, which I'll go through in a little bit more detail. And that system is way farther ahead. It's a very data-rich system. We have a good handle on what's going on down there. We know what kind of efficiencies we'd like to see implemented, and that legislation aligns with that. So it's a great transition into the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The MMPA was passed in 1972, so this was in the same era of some pretty big other environmental laws, ESA, NEPA, Clean Water Act, et cetera. The goals of and this was really triggered by public concern and outrage about dolphin catch in the tuna fishery. The goals of the MMPA are to maintain species or stocks at that optimum sustainable population size and to be a significant functional element in the ecosystem. The MMPA also says to restore depleted stocks and get them back up to OSP. And then finally, the goal is to reduce bycatch and serious injury of marine mammals to essentially a zero mortality rate. So even though there is calculated levels of what's an acceptable amount of bycatch, the policy goal behind it is to drive that to zero.
Mr. Thorburn.
Optimum sustainable population, is that a biologic term, or does it bring in social factors? I would imagine it's not the same as carrying capacity.
That's a great question, Commissioner Thorburn. It is defined in the MMPA. It just talks about being kind of at the heightened level of a population where it's still and contributing to the ecosystem. It is further defined by in federal regulations, and it's defined as that level between maximum net productivity level and carrying capacity. So, the managers needed to operationalize the legal term. So, and I also think it's important as I go through the overview of the MMPA is to call out in different areas. I mean, Congress called it the Marine Mammal Protection Act. It wasn't called the Marine Mammal Management Act, and it wasn't even called the Marine Mammal Conservation Act. And you see the protection value incorporated throughout the act. They really did not intend a very easy way to proceed with take. The MMPA defines take in the first section. There shall be a moratorium on the taking of marine mammals and marine mammal products. And they define take as the harassment or hunting, capturing, or killing of marine mammals or the attempt to do any of those items. And this is really compatible language with what's in the Endangered Species Act. So let's spend a little time on this slide. There are three ways to conduct lethal management of marine mammals under the MMPA. Let's start from the bottom. There's Section 120 that allows for states to conduct intentional lethal taking of individually identifiable pinnipeds that are having a significant negative impact on the decline or recovery of listed salmonids. So this is the permit that we have with ODFNW to conduct removals down at Bonneville Dam. Want to highlight here the fact of individually identifiable. And this language came out in response to some of the work that was going on in the late 80s around Ballard Locks the California sea lions there that were feeding on that population, those fish populations there. There is a provision in the MMPA to where states can actually request a return of management authority back to the state. So essentially, this would, similar to our relationship with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on elk or mule deer, this would just turn the species management to us. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not involved in elk management other than some small populations of elk that are on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuges. So in that sense, it seems pretty straightforward. It is very challenging in that you look at the requirements of returning marine mammal management to the state. It's by stock, and the stock has to be at OSP. Further, it's not just taking one component of management. We would get all of the management for the species. So if there's projects in marine areas that are being developed, we would have the responsibility to make sure that those project proponents were not taking. And again, taking is not just killing, it's also harassment and harming of marine mammals. So it would be a stock-by-stock approach. The way it's written in statute is that we would need to demonstrate that we have a marine mammal management program in place to accept this responsibility. That's, I think, going to be a challenge, because to ask for funding for us to do that work, it becomes a little bit of a chicken and egg argument. We need to demonstrate that we have a program. Well, why would you fund a program where we currently don't have the authority to do the work? So it can kind of go round and round on how do we stage that. Finally, there's a request for a direct take. And essentially what we would do is you would write a request for a waiver of the take moratorium. NIMS would go through rulemaking. There'd be an administrative law judge hearing. And ultimately, we'd get a take permit. All that would also go through simultaneous NEPA, review of that application. Section 120 permits, we have one. The Section 109 has never been implemented. Alaska tried to do it in 1976, and it did not proceed. There has been a handful of applications for a request of the take moratorium. The Macaw tribe submitted one for their take of gray whales and their subsistence harvest. That application was written in 2005, and it's still under review. My point is that this is essentially uncharted territory for all three of. I mean, there is a process for 120, but I think about trying to transfer that authority and that situation to other areas where we'd want to conduct management, perhaps. Section 109 and Section 101 you can't go to the NOAA website and download a form and submit your application for take, and you wait 60 to 90 days and you get it back. This is processes that take years, and it's the kind of thing that we'd want to do very closely with NIMS to make sure that they have the capacity to even review the application and conduct the NEPA analysis that would go along with it. So just wanted to put that out there, that requires a lot of work, and it adds to the complexity of this management issue. Also in the MMPA, they describe a term called potential biological removal, and this is the maximum number of animals that can be removed across all mortality sources by humans. There's an equation for it, and it's spelled out in statute. It's essentially a function of the minimum population estimate multiplied by one-half the growth rate, and it's then applies a recovery factor. So, again, it's the law is written in a way that's incredibly conservative. So you're using a minimum population estimate. You're taking the growth rate, and you're essentially have a correction factor of a half. And then there's a recovery factor, and this is where the ESA comes in. So if a population is listed as endangered, it's a 0.1, so 10% of the potential PBR. If it's a population that's threatened, it's a half. And if it's not listed, then the correction factor is 1. Essentially, it doesn't contribute to the equation. So anyway, just wanted to, for context, then you look at the PBR for Washington stocks. Stellar Sea Lions has across the eastern North Pacific, across all levels of potential take, the annual PBR level would be around 2,500 animals. With California Sea Lions, again, 280,000-300,000 animals, the PBR is 9,200. And because NIMS does not have updated estimates of OSP on any of the harbor seals, they don't have the PBR formally calculated within their stock assessment reports. It's not that hard to do, but it is an administrative item that NIMS would need to do before any of these other items would really proceed. So let's shift to our Section 120 permit in the Columbia River. And I should highlight that this has a lot of partners with us. We could not do this without National Marine Fisheries Service and ODF&W, with the Columbia Intertribal Fish Commission, with the Army Corps of Engineers, just a lot of federal state partners to make this program work. At Bonneville Dam is located at River Mile 145, and in about...
pardon me, Commissioner Hager.
So David just pointed out something, saying, wow, just to make sure everybody notices, this photograph, the slide before, that's a sea lion in the fish ladder?
At Bonneville Dam.
Okay.
So... in about 2002, 2003, some California sea lions followed a smelt run up into the Columbia and then started hanging out at the dam and feeding on salmon. And since then, the numbers have continued to climb, and then we started seeing stellar sea lions show up as well. We tried a variety of items. So we've installed physical barriers to prevent the sea lion from getting into the fishway. We've tried acoustic deterrents. We've tried hazing. And we've relocated animals. Just recently, ODF&W relocated some animals from Willamette Falls when they took them down around Newport. I think one animal returned in 4 days. The others came back in about 6 to 8 days. We did this also at Ballard, where we took 39 sea lions and moved them over to Long Beach. 29 of them returned within a few weeks. So the relocation idea, that's folks will gravitate to that. Hey, why don't we just move these out of the way? They'll come back. It's too good of a lure. That's a lot of food. So when we submitted our application for Section 120, there's a number of criteria that we have to follow. First, that each California sea lion must be individually identifiable, and that requires trapping, marking, branding, essentially, and releasing the animal. An individual sea lion must be observed at Bonneville Dam for 5 days. That individual sea lion must be observed eating a salmon. And that individual sea lion needed to be demonstrated to be subjected to hazing. The Army Corps of Engineers had a report that looked at, well, how many days does it take to achieve all those? It's like 17. And so when you think about, as we're trying to prevent animals from pioneering and establishing and habituating to this behavior, by the time we meet the requirements, we've these are smart animals. If you don't get and try to stop the pioneering animals and show that this is an unfriendly spot to be, we're done. And so just given the current permit requirements and handcuffs, it's really hard to be effective here. The other item to point out is to see a sea lion observing a salmon. These are animals that are in a predation event. They don't spend that much time at the surface. They're not always feeding in a way that you can see the brand by the observer that's on the dam. Or they're feeding right in the whitewater froth at the end of the tail race. Or they're beyond 400 yards where it's really hard to tell what's going on. And so there is a tremendous amount of predation that's just going on in the area that you're not able to detect because the sea lion's doing this. And, well, was that C-120 or was that C-146? It's hard to read the brand. Just to summarize, this is some data from 2017. Folks are still pulling together the 2018 information, where documented 92 California sea lions and 63 Steller sea lions, each species eating between 2 and 3% of the run. I put a strong caveat on this. That is the percent of the run because of the observations along the face of the dam. So, as I said, this is river mile 145. So NIMS did a study a few years ago where they had marked a bunch of fish at river mile zero and released them and tracked their fate as they went through the Columbia. They found that about 20 to 43% of the run could be attributed to pinniped predation. So this isn't 5% of the run or things like that. This is a significant toll that pinnipeds may be taking on listed Columbia River salmon. This slide just shows a table of the amount of animals that we've removed going through even this spring season where we euthanized 29 California sea lions. We've also placed, I think it was around a dozen or 15 animals into aquaria and zoos. So we tried to do that. Most zoos and aquaria already have their California sea lions and hard to find available space, but that's certainly part of our permit requirement as we try to find a home. And if we can't, then we euthanize. The co-managers had submitted a letter to NIMS, and it's in your packet, this past spring to ask for a number of improvements to our Section 120 permit. We asked for the resources for NIMS to be able to review ODF&W's Section 120 removal application to remove California sea lions at Willamette Falls. There's a number of pinniped task force recommendations that we'd like to see NIMS adopt in our permit. One would be to modify that requirement of seeing an individually identifiable sea lion eating a salmon. Right now it says and been observed. We'd like to see that as an or. And we'd also like to reduce the number of days observed from 5 to 3. And then finally, we've been recommending for NIMS to continue to bolster funding for implementation of these programs. With just more and more sea lions returning, where we have now sea lions at Willamette Falls, our resources are going to be spread really thin to address a growing problem. In response to some of those challenges, there's been a bill. A variant of the bill has been floating around Congress for a number of years. This year, we probably have the best chance of success. House Bill 2083, co-sponsored by Congresswoman Herrera Butler, passed out of the House earlier this summer. And then there's a companion bill in the Senate that was just passed out of the Commerce Committee last week. Just looking into the details of this legislation, it just modifies Section 120. It would allow us to remove both California sea lions and Steller sea lions. It moves the geography of the permit. Essentially, to meet the requirement of individually identifiable sea lion, it changes the definition such that an individually identifiable sea lion, if it's upstream of River Mile 112, which is the 205 bridge, well, then that would make that animal eligible for removal. So we wouldn't have to do the catch and release. We wouldn't have to observe it eating a salmon. It doesn't need to be present for a certain number of days. It just needs to be east of River Mile 112. That same definition also applies if salmon are found within tributaries with ESA-listed salmon.
Yes, that's
right. Section 120 right now is just for the states. This would broaden the eligible entities to include the tribes, and it sets the removal level. And that's something that I think a lot of folks are see that in the bill, and it raises some eyebrows. The bill talks about 10% of PBR. And so 10% of the potential biological removal of the stock of California sea lions is 900 animals. And they're thinking, oh my goodness, you're going to remove 900 sea lions there. Well, no. We've shown other data that in some years we might have 150 sea lions there. And that's not to say that all of them would be removed. But it was just to put a number that was a fraction of the potential biological removal, but not have a number that's so specific, say 50, such that if the problem was that we could remove 60, well, now we're stuck because the law only says to remove up to 50. So it's just trying to pick a number that put a ceiling on the potential harvest, but it's a ceiling that, at least on current distribution and numbers of sea lions, it's the ceiling is above what's present. So just moving to towards the end here, certainly with salmon recovery, the agency has been working on all leeches and plus trying to get a handle on predation, whether it's pinnipeds or avian predators or fish predators. We have a variety of programs in all of these arenas. But let's just look at marine survival for a moment. We know that some of the factors that could affect survival include estuary habitat or contaminants and parasite load, or even climate change. Or what about forage fish abundance as a way to have prey swamping, essentially, so that the predators aren't just consuming one available prey items. There's multiple prey items out there. And then the factor of predation. In our early marine survival study that we've been doing for a number of years that the legislature's helped fund, this slide just shows our anchovies in Puget Sound buffering predation on steelhead. And in areas where anchovy abundance is low, we see a really low survival rate of steelhead. Where anchovy populations are higher, we're seeing an increased survival of steelhead. So, based on some of the earlier questions about bioenergetics and thinking about the seasonal time frame of collection of scat and thinking about applying data that was collected off of the mouth of the Fraser River to other areas, what we've been doing is we've had our scientists in our wildlife program and our fish program join together to conduct an assessment of what types of removals are occurring within Washington waters.
Excuse me, Nate. Commissioner McKaysing.
Commissioner Vice Chairman, and thanks again for this presentation. And as we go through it, sometimes it's difficult to catch up and absorb the meanings of what you're presenting here. And your previous slide on anchovies buffering, and that makes some pretty good ecological sense, I think. And I know this gets complicated because you got different years there, but you have survival rate through Puget Sound on the left at 40% in 2016 and all the way down to what looks like about 5% in 2014. And if there was a lot of anchovies in 2016 and not very many anchovies in 2014, that comes into play. Is it also come into play that there could be this gap of the difference between 5% survival rate and 40%, if there aren't anchovies around, that's the magnitude of predation that could be going on for salmon smolts by the seals or pinnipeds?
I think that's what we're trying to portray here, is that the anchovy abundance is buffering predation on steelhead.
So that's the enormous amount of predation. Okay.
And steelhead aren't spending that much time, as opposed to Chinook, where they're hanging out in the estuary. And Puget, steelhead move through the system in weeks. So.
Yeah. And also, Nate, there was a study, I think, downstream of the mouth of Nisqually by the gentleman at NOAA, I can't remember his name, pit tags, where big numbers of pit tags were found on the beach on the sandbars, right? Okay.
So what we're doing is we're trying to compile data from a variety of areas. So a lot of, I showed some of the pinniped flights from early 2000s, and we had this gap, and we've just recently had the Navy funding. So we're pulling together the pinniped distribution numbers and trying to and grouping them based on areas that we think make better ecological sense to evaluate the available prey, either from wild fish or hatchery releases. We're also looking at where do we have scat data collected, and we're trying to put this on the front burner to get some of those scat analyzed, as well as some of the genetics run this summer. So we'll have basically taking the CHASCO methodology and applying it to more specific areas of Puget Sound, and I think that'll be more informative for management purposes and put us in a more defensible spot if it's determined that, hey, this is a significant limiting factor, and is this something we're wanting to intervene? And so that preliminary detail, the folks will do it a heck of a lot better than what I tried to present earlier in the talk about all the bioenergetics modeling, and that'll be coming to you in September. So just to conclude, I think it's really important for us to show leadership on this issue. I think this is a narrative that will get away from us if we're not careful. I think it's a spot where we really need to join with NIMS as the ultimate authority on either permits, or they're ultimately have the authority right now to manage marine mammals. And so this is something that I think that we're going to have a lot more dialogue on, and I just hope some of the background material was helpful.
Nate, I just want to thank you for the presentation. I mean, it was very, very informative, and I think it's a great start, and we need to gain momentum and continue moving forward. So any other questions? Commissioner Graybill.
Nate, again, thank you, too.
So get done with the questions.
The more information we have for the justification of the management of these mammals is very important to have that background. Ultimately, I think the vision of many is to reduce these populations through a variety of methods. What has been demonstrated, I'm just going to caution commissioners that in the past, even if we've gotten the green light to go ahead and euthanize animals, and we're hoping to see at the federal level support for that, we've been stopped by other organizations, and we can just count on lawsuits if we proceed. But I think we should also be prepared that that's a necessary function of how we do business these days, and we're going to have to wade through those processes. But we will have the support of good information like you've provided us today. We'll have the support even at the federal level, and I think it will be more difficult for opposition to sustain their efforts. But that's going to be coming, and I just wanted to make that statement. Thank you.
Commissioner Keogh, Commissioner McIsaac, and then Commissioner Thorburn. No, Commissioner Baker, too. They're all lined up here. Okay, Mr. Commissioner Keogh, please.
Thanks, Nate. Great presentation. So on the legislation that's pending in Congress, I know you mentioned that there's a bill that passed, has already passed the House, and a similar legislation in the Senate. I guess my comment on that will be, I do know that the Senate bill passed the Commerce Committee unanimous consent, which is always a good sign. But we'll see. I mean, with the election coming up, it'd be interesting to see if that bill goes anywhere prior to the lame duck session, and then what happens after lame duck. I'm optimistic. There are certain elements that are of this that are way beyond our control. So just wanted to say that for the record. And then and also I just wanted to ask this: the bill that I'm speaking about, or bills requesting changes to the Section 120 permit. My understanding in that is just limited to Columbia River, or is that not true?
Commissioner Kehoe, that's correct. This would only apply, the changes are only applying to kind of changing the term of individually identifiable sea lion that are upstream of River Mile 112, et cetera. So
right.
It's very constraining.
Very constraining. I guess then probably the thinking is, one step at a time. So with respect to Puget Sound, of course, so now these relaxations of the Section 120 permit wouldn't apply to Puget Sound. Do we have a Section 120 permit for removal in Puget Sound right now? And if not, are there discussions with the federal authorities and with our tribal co-managers about getting a 120 permit for Puget Sound?
That's a good question. The answer is no, we do not have a permit for Puget Sound or the Outer Coast, and we haven't started working on one. Looking at the different management options that are available to us, I don't think Section 120 would necessarily be the best avenue for us if we were to determine that removals were necessary to achieve salmon recovery objectives. I think you'd probably, Section 109, as I indicated, has a tremendous number of challenges. I think probably the best way to go would be to apply for a waiver of the take moratorium and a permit for a specified number of animals because of the requirements of being individually identifiable. That scenario of California sea lions, because on Bonneville Dam, folks are observing above the dam and able to try to read those brands. Even how difficult it is, you still have that logistics. We won't have that opportunity in Puget Sound or Outer Coast that I can think of anyway to meet that requirement.
And pardon me, but this is my last kind of follow-up. So would that be kind of which route to take in Puget Sound and when to start initiating that? Would that be a role of this front table, as Commissioner McIsaac likes to say?
Yes, I think so. This would be something that as we prepare looking the these additional analyses we're doing, complimentary conversations at the Southern Resident Task Force, seeing if these become ideas that are worth taking to the next level. The biological component on figuring out the numbers to remove will be the easy part for this. The socio-political aspects of this will be huge. And so I it's one thing when we're down at the Columbia River where we have a choke point, we're 145 miles upstream, we're investing, society is investing hundreds of millions of dollars into salmon recovery. I mean, Bonneville Power alone's $250 million a year of ratepayer money going into the Fish and Wildlife Program. It's a very data-rich system. Then translating that to Puget Sound, where it potentially has being more visible removal versus what occurs down in the Columbia River Dam. Different settings, you're gonna hear the stories about, well, harbor seals were here, this is a normal spot for them to be, normal spot for stellar sea lions, California sea lions, and aren't there other factors that society should be addressing on salmon recovery? Why are pinnipeds being singled out? So we're gonna have a tremendous, it's going to be really important that the science behind our application is very defensible, not from us just from a scientific scrutiny, but also from a political scrutiny.
Well, that's why we get paid the big bucks.
That's it. Mr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I'm going to withhold a lot of my commentary until after we've had public testimony on the matters of possible policy guidance. But I do have a question relative to Mr. Pamplin bringing up the study by the National Marine Fisheries Service on the Columbia River, where they tried to estimate pinniped mortality, sea lion mortality, mainly on the Columbia, by tagging fish at the river mouth and then looking for recoveries elsewhere. And I happened to pull up that study, and the year of 2014 is the year that you mentioned where the predation estimate came in at about 43%, and that year there were about 314,000 spring Chinook that entered the Columbia River headed to various places. The upriver spring Chinook run reconstruction would have been 243,000, and over 100,000 spring Chinook salmon estimated to be taken by sea lions, so 104,000. So as you said, it can be an enormous number.
Mr. Thornburg.
Thanks, Nate. Really helpful presentation. I put my hand up, just would caution what I heard my fellow commissioner Grable say about the goal of pinniped management. I think we need to be very cautious about saying that it's a reduction in the population. I think our goal is to reduce salmonid depredation by pinnipeds. Example Nate was giving from other species, as you know, I deal with recovery in two extremely vulnerable upland game birds. We have a terrible problem with depredation of these small populations, practically population threatening. Coyotes is one of them. We do coyote lethal take. We do major hunts, but we're not reducing the coyote population. We're because it's a complex system, as Nate has, I think, very well explained. With this situation, we time the hunts so that we think that we might be helping with population reproduction, but we're not reducing coyotes in any way. And I think it's going to be the same with pinnipeds. What we need to accomplish with pinniped management is less depredation of the salmonids.
Yep. Commissioner Baker?
So it's frustrating for me the amount, the many layers of authority and the big words and the science and the time that it takes to get anything done on this, and even trying to decide what get anything done means. And that's kind of what we're wading through here. Some of the letters at the end of this, thank you for providing all of this, by the way, talk about the reason that the Willamette's an issue is that the science has shown that there's an extreme risk of extinction of the wild steelhead up there. So we can go through this and wade through the all the different authorities and time taken to get something done, or we can act like we're trying to get the authority to do something, and whether we do it or not is another decision. But I would like to ask that as part of the next the part of the, you know, phase two of this briefing, I really want to go further into those three management options we have, and I want to know a lot more specifically why we can't just ask for Section 109. And that's both for my benefit, but also because every one of us has to talk to legislators about this, and I've gotten quite a bit of criticism of our saying, well, it's just not a good idea, and it's been direct. We all went to Bonneville Dam and saw them eating salmon, including four senators. I believe all four of them. I know Judy Warnick and Kevin Vandeweghe are banging on us about why we're not doing this, and we don't have good answers. So I'd like to ask that we include that. And as a final thing, this complex ecosystem management is real hard. I mean, it reminds me of the woodland caribou and the wolves up in the up northeast. We get two endangered species. One eats the other one. There's really not a lot we can do. And so that's what I'm asking for here. And I'm kind of asking as well for the quickest way we can do whatever the right thing to do is and how to cut through all the bureaucratic stuff, if there's a way. And I understand really well that, you know, we start killing puppies of the sea in the Puget Sound, we're going to have to be ready for the blowback on that. And so so that's what I'd like to add to the next briefing on this.
Do you like to respond, Nate?
Well, yes, thanks, Mr. Vice Chair. For Commissioner Thorburn, I really appreciate how you characterized what we would submit as for a permit. I think where we have the ability to write permits for specific areas, for specific species, for specific timing, we'll do a better, probably bolster our chances of surviving the legal and social scrutiny versus a broader culling kind of a permit. So, and to Commissioner Baker, we'll certainly add more detail on Section 109. I'll also send you Section 109 just so you can review all of the requirements. Again, some of this is that we have to establish the marine mammal. We're taking all of the Office of Protected Resources functions from NIMS for whatever species we apply for and bringing those into the state. And for species like California sea lion and Steller sea lion, where the range of the stock is not just limited to Washington, but it's to other states or it's to other countries, all of a sudden the management burden that we have that the feds are currently funded for, and we're doing a redundant system, is pretty challenging. And to what end? If the end is to write permits that Commissioner Thorburn just described, well, then maybe we just cut to the chase and pursue those permits directly. So we can dive into more detail on that. I'm going to probably need to either bring in somebody from the AG's office or ask somebody from NIMS to walk through it. I will say that NIMS, they only reviewed one application, it was 1976, so we would be asking a staff person to try to describe a process that they have not done.
I might be asking to dive into less detail. What I'm saying is that we're asked this repeatedly, and why doesn't the West Coast just take this issue and deal with it using our best science, whatever that answer is? I'm not able to answer that yet, and the people that are asking have opinions on us, and I would like those to be good opinions.
Okay. We're a little ahead of schedule, so we're going to take a break because I need a coffee. And we'll come back and continue on at 10 o'clock. Nate needs a break, too, I'm sure. Hey, Nate. Commissioner McIsaac has one question before we go to public comment, if you don't mind. Okay, thank you for allowing the break. It was very pleasant. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. It's a follow-up kind of technical question or science question, I guess, on the Nelson report that you mentioned in your thing. And let me apologize if you already answered this question and I missed it, but I just want to be sure about this. So this is a study by a group of, I think, mostly University of British Columbia professors that took a look at 20 different wild populations, mostly in Puget Sound, and tried to correlate the decline of wild fish with either the abundance of seals or hatchery releases. And oh, there's your slide. Okay, so it says it was negatively associated with Chinook productivity. The density of harbor seals was negatively associated with Chinook productivity in nearly every population of these regions. When I'm looking at the abstract here, it says changes in the number of seals since the 1970s were associated with a 74% decrease in the maximum sustainable yield in the Chinook populations for these 20. So in terms of it being, and then they found that there was no correlation with hatchery fish, but there was a statistically valid correlation with the abundance of seals, but that it explained or was associated with 74% of the decrease that we've seen in wild stocks. And so I ring that out just the abstract. Is that consistent with what you've got here in the slide?
Yes. I mean, you've got it right from the abstract, then yes. That's okay. I think that's I didn't present the amount, but certainly, I mean, I look at this, you know, just one subset of their graphs. I think that pretty much well tells the story, that as seal density increases, the sustainable yield for wild stocks is significantly impacted.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're going to now move to the public input part of this agenda item. We have four people. I'd like to call you up two at a time. You all have been here before, so I don't need to explain policy to you. Lawrence Buckland and Tom Drews, please.
Well, here I am again, Laurie Buckland with Puget Sound Anglers, Gig Harbor. Pinnipeds, we have, as we said here, an extremely difficult situation between the science and the social aspects. I wish I were king for a day, I'd solve it. But that's not going to happen. All I can do is say right now, I want to get in the weeds because I get overwhelmed. We need to put forth the best data that we have, make recommendations based on that data, and pound the table that this is sound data, as difficult as the outcome might be. At least we're intellectually honest in that approach. I would also offer that I think we need to put more pressure, public pressure, on the feds. This is really their problem. They've created it. The law of unintended consequences certainly applies to the Marine Mammal Protection Act. We have no way to readily and promptly, quickly respond to emergent issues. And I would also add that when it comes to NOAA and the feds and ESA, not only does this affect wild Chinook and orcas, this was an issue that kind of got swept under the table during the Rockfish Recovery Plan development. And how many of a severely depleted rockfish species, or now we have two that are listed instead of three, do those seals take, or pinnipeds? We had closures to protect 30 or 40 fish a year, and one pinniped was taken more than that. So it just seems that we need to put pressure on the feds to recognize their responsibilities to come up with a solution under the ESA and make the ESA a precedent over the Marine Mammal Protection Act. That's doable, but I think we need to throw that up in the air and see if it sticks to the wall. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Drews, nice to see you again.
Thanks. Let's see if I can get this thing to work right. So for those of you that don't know me, I've been on the department's Salmon Fishing Advisory Board since 2003. I've got a degree in fishery science from the University of Washington. And on the board, I usually focus on areas 7 through 10 in the marine areas. And I represent Puget Sound Anglers, CCA, and fishermen in the state. I think we have to solve the pinniped issue, or we're not going to help the southern resident killer whales, we're not going to help the salmon, and we're not going to help our fishing culture and heritage. You know, being on the board, I've felt kind of at times like I'm part of the department. And one of the things I'm really proud of and tell people about is that we use the science to manage the fish. You know, we and the co-managers get and we use science to take the emotion and the bias and the politics out of it and do what's right for the fish. And I think you've heard Nate talk a lot about the science. I think the science is there. Talks about, you know, effects on juveniles out migrating. Talks about adults coming back in. Talks about the seal populations and the sea lion populations are way over where they need to be. We need to deal with that now. It's going to take time and effort to do it. It's not the quick, easy, feel-good fix, you know, that we might be looking for. But I think we have to get started. And I think if we are unsuccessful in you know, dealing with pinnipeds, anything else we do isn't going to matter. I really like Commissioner Thorburn's comments on you can't talk about reductions. We need to talk about pinniped management, you know, and we're going to have to be ready to have a media presence and be able to convince the public that this is what's needed to be done. But again, I'm convinced that if we don't solve the pinniped problem, nothing else we do will matter. So thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, we actually have three left. I'll call you all three up at one time, and we can Dave Reese, John Risser, and Ron Garner. Mr. Reese.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to get up at 4:30 in the morning to come down and visit you. I'm here to talk about the pinniped problem, and specifically in the Puget Sound. I've submitted two different pages, and if you'll look at this one when you have time, I'll just kind of outline it. It's a scientific study by Mr. Chasko, and it talks about the annual consumption of Chinook by all pinnipeds has increased tenfold from 68 metric tons to 625 metric tons since 1970 to 2015. The harbor seal consumption of the Chinook salmon within that time has increased eightfold from 1.1 million to 8.6 million salmon. Approximately 100 times the 83,200 that the southern resident killer whales take out. It's just loaded with facts to point out that this is a major problem. This is a major problem that needs to be done with. Taking out a handful on the Columbia River isn't going to solve the problem. It isn't going to save the killer whales. I personally believe that the killer whales are that canary that's in the birdcage in the mine, and we're seeing them decline. It's went from 79, I believe, from 83 to 79. In the last couple of years, and I think it's going to continue to fall if we don't get them the food that they're used to eating. I want to thank you for the work you've done on the HSRG and allowing us to up the production in the hatcheries. That's going to help, but those fish aren't going to come back for 4 years. This is a problem that's happening right now. This other article that I submitted, it says, tens of thousands of seals in the Salish Seas are devouring millions of an adult and juvenile, sparking a renewed debate about culling the furry predators. Tenfold increase in the population of harbor seals within BC waters since then is linked to a massive drop in the marine survival of Chinook salmon in 14 of the 20 wild populations. The plight of the BC endangered orcas adds some urgency to the debate. There are only about 75 members in the resident group left, down from 83 2 years ago, compared with 40,000 seals in the Strait of Georgia alone. This is a problem that needs to be dealt with. I'm with Puget Sound Anglers, and I've seen our seasons go down and down and down, and that's not solving the problem, and I don't believe that will solve the problem. If we didn't fish at all, it wouldn't solve the problem. That's not the problem. The problem is that these sea lions get up in the rivers and they eat the smolt as they're coming down. They just devour them, not only them, but there's other predators that do that also. The birds do that. But we need to be able to get those fish out there and get them back in, or you're going to lose the whale, and who knows what other species are going to go with it. I think the whale is just the first. It's the canary. And so we need to save the canary. We need to not destroy all the seals. I don't think that's the right answer. I think we need to control them.
Wrap up. Your time's over.
Okay.
Right, please.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. John?
Yes, I'm John Risser. I got off work last night at 11, came in, got up at 4:30 with him, but came on down here from Stanwood. My thing is, I am a fisherman. I'm not usually a part of the meetings here. I've been out there. I'm a boat owner. I've caught the fish. I've lost the fish at the boat when the seals have taken it from us at the long line way out or right at the boat. They just boil right up, take the fish, and they're gone. And you've also seen YouTubes where they've taken a baby or a child off the dock. If you go down to Westport, where I fish a lot at, I'm always afraid of my dog who's on the dock with me jumping in the water. She's a Chesapeake being taken. They are a problem. They are taking the fish. They are consuming too many of them. And the other thing I like to talk about is I got a letter up for you guys to look at from Brett Rawson from Highland Charters. He's talking about foregone conclusion that right now we're talking about this. You guys already pretty much made your decisions, and based on the threat of lawsuits, you got a lot of pissed off fishermen who are losing the right to go fishing, and we're seeing the sea lions out there, and we haven't taken responsibility of what could be done, and we would like for you guys to take the responsibility, do something for us, get that authorization to take out some of the seals, not all of them. We're not looking at it. We are conservationists in our own heart. We want the right things done. We don't want everything taken, and we really want something done. And we would like to have, you know, the discussion of the prey availability and what they're going to do for us, the cormorants and the seas, sea lions and seals. So that's good enough for me. Please look at the letter.
Thank you. Ron Garner, you got the caboose.
Oh, boy. Thanks, everybody. Welcome, Mr. Kelly Suswin, for joining, taking the toughest job in Washington State. At least you and I don't have a lot of hair to pull out. There's some left, though, and it hurts. Anyway, thanks, Jay. Going to miss you off the board here. So, anyway, I'd like to really talk about what's going on out here. The media really is putting us in a bad picture. I got interviewed by Cairo, and they were waiting for me to say, shut down sport fishing. And I gave a 20-minute interview, and the only thing that made it was, we got to do something. They asked me if I would shut down sport fishing, and I said, we already have. We're down to 10 days in Marine Area 9. Since I didn't say what they wanted to, they took Jocks White and put him on there because he said yes, he would. Anyway, I would like to talk about several things that are still the problem. The HSRG, you thankfully fixed, but it's too bad that we had to get this far down the road. ESA, HSRG funding cuts. Here's working with Mr. Nate there. You have one sheet here that shows license fishing revenue, $65.9 million. We're $30 million in the hole for the budget. If we go and take out fishing like the media is trying to pin on us, it's going to be even a bigger hole. You're going to lose so much revenue from fishing licenses. And those of us that are doing this understand what's going on, which I think all of you do too. I've talked to Nate about a lot of things, but this Chasco paper right here says, it's within Puget Sound, Washington State. This is all highlighted on your sheets. Right here, 2015, pinnipeds consumed double that of resident killer whales, six times greater than that combined commercial and recreational catches. There's one over here that says, however, harbor seals, stellar sea lions, and California sea lions also prey on Chinook salmon, and prey limitation has been identified as one of the biggest threats to resident killer whales, in part In particular, the inland waters of Washington State and British Columbia are thought to have the highest densities of harbor seals in the world, with abundance spurred by rapid population growth over the period 1970 to 2000. This goes on. There's a lot of information in here, and it's highlighted. In 3 minutes, I'm not going to make it. A thank you to the Lummi Tribe for following up a letter to David Trouts, who is basically their wild fish conservancy on the tribal side. A lot of our buddies that I used to run with that were the Kool-Aid, you know, Kool-Aid drinkers were talking about David Trout, and I said, well, I think you need to go to another biologist in the tribes, and I bet you won't find another one that agrees with him. So he tried saying that Puyallup, there isn't enough habitat, which is, nobody agrees with that. So as I'm asking for your help today to make some kind of a statement, to come out of this meeting making a statement that we need to do something about this, and I'm willing to go meet with you, the director, the tribes. The tribes are so much on our side. We're not hearing a lot from them, but they're in there in the Orca Task Force with us, and they're working with us. They're extremely sharp, but our message isn't getting out, the pinnipeds. It's kind of stifled, and there's a lot of diverse backgrounds in there that where they don't understand. They don't want to go there, you know, and management is sometimes making a tough decision. I'm an employer. Sometimes I don't want to have to fire somebody, but sometimes I have to, you know, and it's just a part of doing the right job. I really appreciate the way that you characterize that, Kim, and Dave, it was good seeing you, and you have good points, too, and it's not going to be easy at all. But it has to be done, and I'm afraid that if we don't jump on working on the Puget Sound pinnipeds and birds right away, it's just going to keep going farther down the road. And we're the longer we wait, the worse it's going to get. So one really important piece you need to know is Phil Anderson made a really good talk there at the meeting.
Be brief, Ron. Finish up. Go ahead and say what you got to say, but be brief.
You got a bunch of people behind me, I know.
No, you're the last one, but we got some work to do, too.
Yeah, I'm going
to
be real quick about this.
All right.
So Phil told them over there at the meeting that he had the Pacific Salmon Treaty has set aside fish through the Pacific Salmon Treaty for the orcas to get through and to feed them. So it has been done. And there's this big push to close the west side of San Juan Island. And Senator Ranker's one of them. And I said, hey, you know, it's not needed. We got it covered. Phil went into detail. Now, he's also, right now, I asked him to work on this. Several years ago, NOAA did a study to show where the fish, if we were to stop fishing, what would it do? It wouldn't make a difference. You'd still lose your salmon. We have knocked it down so far without change. Phil's putting this together now. He's trying to get it, I think, from Peter Dygert. But anyway, this is another important piece. But I really think right now we get the tribes to go with this, and it'd be really hard to knock us down if we're all together.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate all you guys' comments.
Thanks.
Mr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me also add thanks to people who got up early and drove all the way to testify. I've been thinking a lot about this since April when it first came up, and I think maybe to start the dialogue, I'd like to put a motion out. It's five sentences long is all, and Tammy, so if we could put that up there. If I do get a second, I would like to speak to the motion. And the motion would be for a policy position on reducing pinniped predation on salmon. The motion says, based on the information on record at this time, and until such time as there is a more equitable balance between the population abundant status of pinniped species and ESA-listed wild salmon populations in the state of Washington, the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission advocates for authorization for greater flexibility in management of pinniped populations in federal and state legislation towards a goal of significantly reducing pinniped predation on salmon. Further, the commission tasked the director with expeditious and efficient implementation of any flexibility forthcoming from successful passage of such legislation, if it occurs. This policy position applies to the Columbia River, coastal river basins, and Puget Sound, including the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Flexibility in management activity should include a priority to actively discourage pinniped residents in areas of salmon predation, including effective harassment and lethal removal, both done in a humane manner that discourages residents and predation behavior. As part of the management flexibility advocated by this policy position, the Commission encourages and supports the resumption of cultural hunting by treaty Indian tribes for pinnipeds in a manner consistent with traditional cultural use customs and scientific principles of predator wildlife management, with a focus on situations, areas, and animals with salmon predation problems. If there's a second, I'd like to speak to it.
We have Commissioner Holzmiller.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion and a second.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. And speaking just at the top two sentences, first, the essence of this motion is to formally recognize that we have a problem. Pinniped predation is not neutral to salmon survival rates. It's not positive. It's not a positive factor. It's a negative factor. The Chasco et al. Paper found that in adult equivalents by 2015, pinnipeds consumed twice the amount of killer whales and six times the amount taken by combined sport and commercial fishing. National Marine Fisheries Service scientists have estimated on the Columbia River in 2015, over 40% of the spring Chinook run may have been taken by pinnipeds, over 100,000 fish from the upriver run. And lastly, the recent Nelson et al. Paper reported a 74% decline due to pinnipeds in 14 of 20 wild populations studied. So I think it's obvious we have a problem. The key phrasing in the first sentence is towards a goal of significantly reducing pinniped predation on salmon. It's important that no one exaggerate this phrasing into a call for some sort of huge lethal removal. Pinnipeds are very smart animals, and I believe there can be various ways to significantly reduce salmon predation behavior, and I'll allude to that a little bit later in the motion. We've heard that a bill is moving through Congress that has progressed to key stages. The last sentence in this paragraph is important, that should federal legislation succeed, and it may not, the policy guidance would be to seek reductions in salmon predation in very short order. And I defer to Commissioner Kehoe, who has mentioned this in the past, I think in April and since, if he has any comments on that last direction. With regard to the middle paragraph, I would like to reiterate that the goal is to reduce predation on salmonids. Pinnipeds are highly intelligent, quick learners. Discouraging residents in key salmon areas and discouraging salmon predation is the objective, not necessarily a large-scale lethal removal of pinnipeds. Effective harassment is a key descriptor in that it relates to the predation behavior of pinnipeds not lethally removed. These animals are very smart. They've learned to come to fish ladder entrances. They've learned to come to hatchery release outfalls when smolts are released. They've even learned to come on boats and get bait out of bait boxes. They've learned it's safe to haul out on docks, to go to other unnatural human-created havens. They can also learn whether or not areas of high salmon predation are dangerous to be at. This position does not say how to affect behavior change. We leave that up to the behavior biologists and experts to determine. For the Columbia River, sea lions have learned to feast in freshwater, artificial human-created obstacles like Bonneville Dam and its fish ladders, even at hatchery outfalls where smolts are released. On the Columbia River, it's time to start to emphasize the sea part of the sea lions. With regard to the last sentence on the tribal involvement, I understand that the Marine Mammal Protection Act in its 1994 reauthorization included a provision stating that nothing in this act was to abrogate the rights of Native American tribes to take marine mammals. However, this provision was interpreted in litigation to require compliance with all other provisions, which was affirmed in a 2004 Anderson v. Evans case at the Ninth Circuit Appeals. And marine mammal takes, I understand, by tribes have not been authorized since 2004. The language in this motion is to encourage going back to the original congressional intent. This last sentence of this motion is meant as a statement of respect to our tribal co-managers. I want to intentionally avoid issues associated with non-treaty tribe hunting rights. That's all for a separate federal process. This is simply meant to be a signal to the Native American tribes that we respect their ability to contribute to solutions on this important matter. Well, some might suggest that the commission taking this action is somewhat moot, because the Governor Inslee has a letter on this already. There's been staff comments in the press or in the halls of Congress about this legislation. While that's true, I think the commission is the policy oversight body of this agency, and in my opinion, a policy position that recognizes pinniped predation on salmon is a problem and generically advocates for addressing the problem is an important impetus towards experts working on solutions to the problem. Lastly, it's important to note that there can be significant benefits to the southern resident killer whale pods from less competition from these increasing pinniped populations. The recent science indicates that seals are kind of beating the killer whales to the punch, so to speak, when it comes to salmon predation. They're preying on the juvenile salmon in their early out migration to saltwater in very large numbers, 8.5 million smolts in 1 year, according to one of the studies. This competition for the same food source is a serious ecological problem for the southern resident killer whales. Yesterday, we talked at length about more Chinook salmon from hatcheries as part of the executive order initiative on this. It'd make no sense to do this just so pinnipeds could shortstop huge amounts of Chinook salmon before the orca can get them. And Mr. Vice Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. At the request of Mr. Freymeyer, we're going to take 5 minutes, and we'll get back and continue this discussion. Okay, back in session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been pointed out that there might be some complexities in the last sentence of this motion that might result in some misperceptions and that kind of thing. So I would be open, if any of the commission members were interested in an amendment to the motion, to remove the last sentence.
Mr. Kehoe.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I would propose or move to amend the motion by striking the last sentence.
We have a motion and a second. Are there any other comments? Commissioner Holzmiller, and then Gray Bill.
Being a fellow that tries to keep life as simple as possibly can, on the deal with the Columbia River pinniped issue, I think we're really close to being able to win that one. Would we be ahead to deal with the Columbia River, get a statement on that, and try and push that ball over the goal? Or do you think we want to go the full meal deal?
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Maybe as a point of order, when we finish with this amendment, I would like the opportunity to address that, because that's part of the second paragraph of the geography. So the amendment right now is just to remove the tribal sentence.
Okay.
Vice Chair.
I'm sorry. I thought, David, did you?
Well, actually,
I was going to call for the question on the amendment, okay. I think we all have some issues. Yeah.
Okay. Regarding the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same. Motion carries. Mr. McIsaac.
Yes, in response to the question about the geography, the current bill is just the Columbia River, and in fact, it's just above River Mile XYZ on the Columbia River. This motion is to advocate for greater management flexibility in legislation. So the current legislation, which is limited to the Columbia River, might fail. It might get amended on the floor. It might get amended in conference. And so I thought it was important, and it might fail altogether and have to be reintroduced in the next session. But all of those things are possibilities, and whether or not that happens or not, I thought it was important for the commission to recognize that we have a problem on pinniped predation throughout the state. And maybe there'll be another bill come down the line that deals with Puget Sound if this one passes as it is now. And so the purpose here is to go bigger and just recognize that there is a problem in other areas, and that it would be taken as a position advocacy for everywhere that would last for a while, depending on what other legislation might happen in the future.
Commissioner Kehoe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. And to further respond to your question about Columbia River, Commissioner McIsaac, that the last sentence of the first paragraph tasks the director with expedition and efficient implementation of any flexibility forthcoming from successful passage of such legislation. That is directed toward this bill that we heard about, that Herrera Butler's bill and Senator Cantwell's bill, that pertains to the Columbia River. So my thought is behind this language, to further explain it, is assuming we get passage, presuming President Trump signs the bill into law, that we direct the staff and the department to seize the moment and not delay in using that greater flexibility as quickly as possible, in coordination with the other interested groups, the state of Oregon, NOAA, and the tribe. So I think, to answer your question, Jay, you know, the focus, at least with respect to that last sentence, is on the Columbia River piece.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Commissioner Thorburn.
No.
Mr. Graybill, and then Commissioner Keeney.
In respect to your motion, Don, I think it's been suggested to me that where you refer to salmon, predation on salmon, in a couple of different areas, that we change that to salmonoids, so it includes steelhead. That has been suggested in
some on it. Yes. Mr. Isaac?
I don't know if that would require an amendment, but I would say that, you know, Salmonids is entirely consistent. I may have even been thinking the genus Oncorhynchus, which does now have steelhead in it. So I would say on the record that's a good interpretation.
Mr. Freymeyer, do we need an amendment?
As long as that director understands what your policy statement means.
Very good. Thank you. Commissioner Keeney.
Thank you. And I'm definitely in line with the thinking of this policy position and for some type of policy position that supports what we've been talking about here. I feel a little bit that it's a little too broad. Columbia River, yes, but I understand what you're saying, that you're keeping the door open for where there are other problems. But I sense from the presentation we had that we're being brought along, step by step, so that first we have the base knowledge, and I would guess staff has some plans to increase that base knowledge and or help find some direction for us or give us guidance. This could come back through staff as a suggested policy recommendation with their input, because they're involved in a lot of things we aren't. The task force is moving along. So I guess what I'd like to do now is, while staff is here, is ask you what you think about the timing of this, the breadth of it. Is it on the right track in your mind, or is there something else you were thinking? If we were to develop a policy statement or vote on this one today.
Could I add to that question?
Mr. Thorburn.
And I presume that you've talked to
Kenny Becker as well, because the other part that's going forward is the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force, and certainly it will be great to be sort of in line with directions that they're taking as well. So if you have a comment on that, Penny, in regards to this, or if you can take that into consideration, Nate, I think that would also help us to think about it.
Nate. Thanks, Mr. Vice Chair, and I guess I'd begin by fully acknowledging that the Commission sets policy for the department, and so I appreciate the opportunity to provide input, but we follow your all's instruction. And so there's, I think from a timing standpoint, we've got a lot in place to support the pending federal legislation right now. And so if this is seen to help that, we're on a pretty good path right now. And so I guess we wouldn't need this motion per se to help. And so it doesn't necessarily hurt us, but it doesn't add. So then why would the timing be for Puget Sound or the coastal bays? I feel like there's some additional work that still needs to be done. And then lastly, there's some elements of the wording that I would probably edit. There's some aspects, for instance, about advocating authorization in federal and state legislation. When you look at Section 109 of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, it says that the state shall not adopt laws regarding marine mammals. And thus, you know, I mean, technically written here, we're advocating for a position that's in violation of federal law. And it's those types of nuance. I get it. It's a broad policy position, and I'm taking it very literally. But when I think about the Commission coming out and putting forth a position statement, we need it to be 100% watertight. And it's those types of elements that I think that we could work with the Commission to develop a position statement that's consistent with the values that you've all expressed, that's also watertight from a legal perspective. So thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you.
I think just all comments off the fly.
Sure. Yeah, and I appreciate that we set the policy, but boy, we look for guidance a lot from staff, and it's always been good. So in my mind, this is something like this is would be very positive for the Commission to put together and put out, but I think it needs a little more work based on what I heard.
Commissioner McIsaac?
Thank you. Penny, want to?
No.
Okay, sorry.
Or wait.
Don't need her up there.
Sorry.
I'll explain why later.
Commissioner Thorburn, I guess I just, if you wanted me to, I'm happy to give a little update on where the task force is in relation to this issue. In general, I would say that this, the place that the task force is in right now is they're hearing potential actions that range a full variety of options on the predation front. This last week, they met and talked about which things they think should go forward, which things they needed more information on in order to make decisions. On the 28th of August is a meeting in Anacortes where the task force will be making their recommendations for what should go into the report to the governor. The lethal removal of pinnipeds in particular was one option that the task force expressed interest in knowing more information about, in particular asking the prey working group for more details around the potential effectiveness of that action to help killer whales, the ease of implementation, which includes all the social and political issues around that, and then the affordability of the action. So those are the things that the prey working group is working on right now, trying to provide more information to the task force on. And we met as the prey working group on Thursday, talked about that in depth, and there were a lot of folks that wanted to create more specific recommendations the task force could move forward with, depending on the level of information that's available in the different geographic areas. So, for instance, separating the Columbia River scenario from Puget Sound was something that the working group felt pretty strongly about because they are such different scenarios. Yeah.
Mr. Vice Chairman, in response to Commissioner Caney's questioning, line of questioning there, regarding the timing, so back in April, I had mentioned that I'd been contacted by Congresswoman Herrera Butler's office about what the opinion of the commission might be. And I said I was only one commissioner. And I let them know that the commission scheduled this for August. And I said, is that too late? Is that going to help at all? And they said, no, that might be perfect timing. I think it would send a good signal if the commission had an opinion on this while this was all percolating in Congress. I asked about whether or not just referring to the Columbia River or not was important, and they said, no, we just would like to hear what the commission thinks about anything. So I think waiting longer begets waiting longer. And when is the time to do something? I think now is the time to send some sort of a signal out. Just heard about the task force. They want to know a little bit more about lethal removal. This motion talks about lethal removal. It talks more about behavior modification. I would hope that's something they would like to know. If they want to know what people are thinking, I would hope they would want to know what this commission thinks about these kind of things. So I'm concerned that delay begets delay, and that back in April, I was hoping that the commission would take some sort of a position on this. And so I'm concerned about delay beginning delay.
Mr. Keeney.
No, that's well appreciated, those thoughts. And you still have time, I think, as a commission to make sure we're not stepping into some territory with the wording of this that puts us at odds with, as was just mentioned by staff, you know, even some of the legality of what we're saying in the words. And so what I'm more worried about is, you know, as our meeting comes to a close today, we're trying to wordsmith this to make sure it's right. And it's the first time we've all seen it, in my mind, but I'm not against doing it. But, you know, to get to your timing element, you know, could this be run back through staff for their input? Again, we set policy, but they have valuable input. Before your teleconference on a week from today or a week from Friday, and still make your decision and still move forward with a policy. So I'm not saying let's postpone it forever. It's just I think there's enough doubt in my mind about the breadth of it. You know, should it just be more narrowed to the Columbia and then some of the other words that were brought up? That's all.
Commissioner Grayville.
My concern is, as pointed out by staff, that it may be necessary to change language because of a violation of statute. So I don't want to delay it. I agree. I mean, I think it's important that we make a statement, but I don't want to embarrass the commission by having something out there that's in error.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there's probably some difference of opinions on whether this advocates for violations. And I would try to clarify for the record right now, it does not do that. This is an advocation for flexibility in federal and state legislation that might happen. Who knows what might happen in federal legislation that regards state legislation possibilities? Okay. This is not advocate that the state. It's not intended to advocate that the state run in and pass a law before Congress does and be in violation of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. I don't think the legislature would do that, even if we did recommend it. So I'm not that concerned about that part of it.
I'm not concerned either. I think that the state law reference, you know, this is not law. This is just a policy statement, and So it can't be viewed as in violation of some sort of federal preemption in that area. It's just a statement, and who knows what could come down the line. There could be some flexibility given to the states in the future under federal legislation. I think my personal view is this is a broad policy statement. It is what it is. It allows now us to go on the record, if it passes on Monday, saying, yeah, we support as a commission pursuit of legislation that provides more flexibility than we currently have under current law to address pinniped populations with respect to salmon recovery, and also sends a strong message to the agency that if and when this current legislation that is pending passes, which could be in short order, that we do not delay at all in implementing it. So I'm prepared to vote in favor of the motion today.
I was going to make some similar comments, but I'll just say I agree with Commissioner Kehoe, and I will support the motion as well.
Mr. Baker. Well, after all my heartfelt speeches about cutting through all the bureaucracy, I'd like I have a bit of heartburn with this, and so I have a suggestion. Don't know if it'll go anywhere. If we have the big task force making recommendations on Puget Sound and elsewhere soon, I think that's what I heard you say, end of the month?
The task force is going to decide if their recommendations will include specific actions to those places.
Okay, so in terms of what we can do right away, the Columbia River, everybody seems to agree. Us piling on now would be, I think, useful. I think if that's what Congressman Herrera Butler wants, I think from what I've heard, we all agree. From what I've read, we've got Joe Storr on record. We've got Jim Unsworth on record. We've got a whole bunch of people on record on this. What I appreciate about this talk is that one of the things that I've been asking for is, hey, come ask us, maybe earlier, before we send letters in from the department advocating this position or that. What I'd like to ask Commissioner McIsaac if he would be comfortable with is for today passing the first paragraph of this motion, which advocates for increased flexibility and tasking the director with expeditious and efficient implementation, reserving the second paragraph, which takes the fairly broad statement geographically across pretty much everywhere that we have authority over, until the end of our next meeting, where I've asked for not only more science, but also more what our options are under the federal law. Commissioner Kehoe is probably a better lawyer than I am, but I have a bit of concern that I haven't had a chance to look at this and wordsmith it at all, nor has the department. So I'd like to do this in two stages, and that's what I'm asking. And I would be happy to vote in favor of the first paragraph and reserve judgment, but reserve only for a month judgment on the second.
Can continue to have a dialogue on those points. You mentioned something about under current law with regard to the bigger geographic areas in this. There's a second sentence in that paragraph as well that I think is important that has to do with emphasizing discouraging pinniped residents in areas of salmon predation. So I think that paragraph is important in that regard. But the point of this is not to conform to current legislation. The point of this is to recommend that current legislation be altered, and that it be altered to provide greater flexibility for pinniped population management. And I don't know what information we would get at the next meeting with regard to Puget Sound that would change the conclusion that pinniped predation in Puget Sound is a problem right now. I mean, we've got this science out there that showed some pretty stark things, that graph on the anchovy buffering, for example. And so the other population... Well, anyway, there's lots of science out there right now that I don't think is going to get turned around in September to make us think that Puget Sound area does not need any further flexibility than the current law, which is highly protective. I mean, it's a success story, this Marine Mammal Protection Act. It's done a wonderful job of protecting pinnipeds and marine mammals. And it's done such a good job now that it's causing problems for salmon and steelhead. So I would, in terms of dialogue, I would urge you to think about the pros and cons of making a statement now and continuing to learn more about all this. And at that, and there's always going to be more details about where, how many, this detail, that detail, and the next detail, and delay begets delay, even when it's not intended to.
I'm going to make one brief comment, then Commissioner Thorburn. I feel, honestly, that on behalf of the citizens of the state, and my knowledge of their views on things, I think we absolutely have to mention the coastal river basins and Puget Sound in this to get the message across about what our objectives are and what we're trying to do to give this agency the authority to engage on this in a positive way. Commissioner Thorburn.
I really appreciate this discussion. This is difficult to think through. The first reason I raised my hand was to suggest that Commissioner Baker just make a motion to amend, which I still think might be a good idea to contribute to this. Discussion. I also wanted to issue another caution. We heard the discussion yesterday about interpreting scientific literature and a warning to not take association as cause. And we heard that we just heard a statement that it's the Marine Mammal Protection Act that has led to this explosion of pinnipeds. And we heard a presentation earlier that said these are complex systems, and there's probably a lot that has contributed to the explosion of pinnipeds, which I heard out of the discussion is being expeditiously worked on by our science staff, and we're going to hear about that in September. And I agree with Commissioner Baker. I think that having more information with a month delay might help me to make a better informed decision about the way forward that we want to support with pinniped management in these broader areas.
Do you have some, let me ask, what particular information are you looking for? What's going to change the landscape? I guess Commissioner Baker has a comment.
I think what I'm looking for is the peace of mind to have this, the second paragraph, wordsmithed so I know exactly what we are doing. I agree with everything written on this document, and it's just that I hadn't seen it until 10 minutes ago, and I'm not sure what we are authorizing. Now, after listening to Commissioner McIsaac, I'm even a little less sure. I think
I didn't know that this, I hadn't read this as basically an invitation to Congress to expand the jurisdiction of the bills presently pending. I'm not sure, number one, that's our place, but number two, we'd weigh that bill down so it'd sink like stone, would be my guess if we did that. And so I'm looking at this as future, giving our director the chance to, the authorization to say, hey, we believe in this and we want you to expeditiously authorize action now and cut through all the bureaucratic crap. So what I'm saying is I just want to wait a month on the second paragraph. And unless what we're talking about in the first paragraph is some sort of an amendment process in Congress that I hadn't even thought about.
Mr. McIsaac.
Chairman, it was not intended that this broader geographic applicability would be a call to change the current, to be opposed to the current legislation in Congress because it does not go far enough. No, I would hope that if this motion would pass, the people that have that legislation in their hearts would say, this supports that. They would actually support a little bit more. They think there's a problem in Puget Sound, but I would hope they would not say, oh, because you don't have all of these areas, no, this current bill should be shot down. And like you say, sink it. That would not be the intent. But like I said, you don't know what's going to happen in Congress. You don't know about whether the current bill will fail. You don't know if someone will consider an amendment, when they get together on a final version, if it gets out of the Senate or on the Senate floor or wherever. And if at that point in time someone says, well, what does the commission think? Should it only be the Columbia River? Oh, darn, we were thinking about doing something for Puget Sound, but they cut that out of their motion, so they must not want us to do anything in Puget Sound. And that would not be the intent of this either. It's a broad, general position at recognizing that there is a problem with salmon predation caused by pinnipeds and urging that there be solutions wherever they can be. And then, so.
Any other comments? Hearing none, I'm going to call for the question on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We are at number, oh, pardon me.
Mr. Chairman, just let me say one last thing as this goes out and we're done with it. This is the second time where it's become apparent to me that it would be a good thing to have a two-meeting process on any of these kind of complexities. Yesterday was one example. This is another one. And so as a new kid on the block, it's more used to what people are comfortable with. Certainly not my intent to put people in an uncomfortable, on-the-spot position. And as we look to the agendas, I will try to keep that in mind if I do one of these exercises where I think a lot about it and think this is the time to deal with it or we're in a problem and try to not have that happen the best I can.
Larry, on that?
Mr. Baker.
I'd also like to say that if not two meetings, at least maybe a day or two to review this kind of thing. But I do want to express my admiration for the amount of work that you do on this commission, because I think it's causing all of us to up our game a bit. And so thank you for the amount of work. I can't react quickly enough to think that I'm doing a good job when I get this a few minutes before.
Mr. Graybill.
I agree with Commissioner Baker. I believe that what you bring to the commission is well worth our attention, but when it's delivered, we're passing a copy around the table to try to digest this. And yesterday, this was an item that could have severe impact on our budget, but to have it delivered to us at that time, I think it's unreasonable, and I'm very uncomfortable about trying to take action on something with such a short window of time to try to understand it. So I appreciate, Don, that you recognize that, and we'll try to provide us with information in the future and further advance. You started discussions on this in April, and we didn't see it until a few minutes before this meeting. Thank you.
Okay, we're now